Are we good? I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes, Wednesday, March 4th, 2015. We will move to the second item on the agenda, Senate File 381. Senator Clausen, welcome to the committee. Senator Clausen, we're pleased to have you present Senate File 381.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair, committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 381, modifying the duration of certain nonprofit fundraising events. During the 2014 legislative session, two nonprofit sales tax exemption modifications were passed. The first provision set a limit on gross receipts. Educational or social organization fundraising sales for individuals under 18 years of age or a senior citizens group are exempt from sales tax if the gross receipts do not exceed $20,000. The second provision, revenue gathered at fundraising events sponsored by nonprofit organizations, are exempt from sales tax if the event is less than 5 days in length. Senate File 381 expands the sales tax exemption for fundraising events sponsored by a nonprofit organization by increasing the number of fundraising sale days from 5 to 10 days. Fundraisers by nonprofit organizations would be exempt from sales tax requirements if the event lasts no more than 10 days. Minnesota has a long history of supporting nonprofit fundraising efforts. Nonprofits are essential to the vitality of communities and contribute to the Minnesota quality of life due to their public benefit mission. One such nonprofit organization is the Dakota County 4-H. The Dakota County 4-H relies on sales at their Dakota County Fair concessions booth to support organizational activities. Unfortunately, the Dakota County Fair is a 7-day event, and therefore the current sales tax exemption does not apply. Based on data from the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs, we have 11 counties that have fairs longer than 5 days in Minnesota, and there is also a fiscal note for your review. With us today, we have two testifiers, Bruce Adams, 4-H volunteer and Dakota County 4-H finance director, and Jeff Wiesensell, Rosemont community member, also a member of the City Council of Rosemont. He is a 4-H, former 4-H member, and the father of three daughters that participated in 4-H activities. So, Madam Chair, if we could receive testimony.
Thank you. First of all, just let me ask if there's any questions from the members. Seeing none, who would like to go first? Good morning, and if you would identify yourself for the record, we'd be pleased to have your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Bruce Adams, and I live at 916 Southwind Drive in Burnsville, Minnesota. And I am here as a citizen and a concerned person who's been involved in 4-H for basically my entire lifespan. I was a second-generation 4-H member. My mother was a 4-H leader in our home county. I grew up in Meeker County, with Litchfield being the county seat. And she was a leader in the 4-H organization before I was even old enough of my brothers to be involved in 4-H. It was an extremely beneficial program for myself. I learned a lot, I appreciated a lot, and it gave me a much better picture at that period of time of what the whole state was really like, because if I was involved in a county activity, I got to meet people from one end of the county to the other. At the state fair, I got to meet people from across the entire state. One of my certainly prime goals was to get my daughter involved in 4-H when she became old enough. She became active in 4-H. My bribe was, okay, if I'm going to be in 4-H, I want a rabbit. So even though I didn't know a whole lot about rabbits, I became a proud parent of a bunch of little bunnies. And she did very well in the 4-H program. What was really exceptional is she got involved in the 4-H Rabbit to Judging program, which is a youth activity. And by reading and reading and reading, I became the volunteer coach. And it improved her public speaking ability so much. It improved her confidence. And she, too, got to know people from one end of the county to not the other, not just in our neighborhood or in her school. I saw the benefit when I would go to parent-teacher conferences and listen to the discussions of Megan as, well, Megan is willing to volunteer to do this. Megan's not scared to do this first. Megan is a great public speaker and organizer. When I was on the Planning Commission, she'd come along with meetings to me, and she was a nice, quiet participant in the audience, unlike other kids that I may have seen. And so I saw a great benefit. I followed Jeff as a finance director and adult treasurer in the county, and this is a concern for us because there are kids that don't have as much equal opportunity because of finances, and we can aid them in some scholarshiping of activities within our county level, and every little dollar that we can put into this is magnified by the volunteers that we have. So I look at this as a great benefit to our county, Dakota County, but it's a benefit across the whole state. As I said, I grew up in a rural area of the state. I now live metropolitan, but there's value to 4-H and the other philanthropic activities by other organizations across the whole state, and we appreciate your consideration. Within Dakota County at the moment, our normal enrollment members is about 900 youth within the county. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
So, Mr. Adams, what qualities makes a bunny a prize winner? That's my main question.
Well, it's one of those actual amazing things. You look at a rabbit when you're growing up and you see the pets and things of that nature. There is an organization called the American Rabbit Breeders Association, and there is a soft cover book that is about 300 pages long with standards for breeds, and within breeds there are colors. There are even within one of the breeds, the small Netherland Dwarfs, there's even an eye color differential. And you look at toenails to see if one is off-colored from the other. So just like everything that we do in life, there are benchmarks that you measure against. And the American Rabbit Breeders Association has benchmarks, and the kids learn to study this book. And then the great part about it that I saw for my daughter specifically and all the youth that I saw involved in this was the fact that they had four rabbits in a class that they were to judge. They were to place them according to 1, 2, 3, 4, and then they verbally supported their determination with oral reasons in front of judges. And the wonders it did for the youth that I saw and still see today was just phenomenal.
Do they have national competitions like a Westminster dog show?
It's somewhat lower tone than the Westminster. I've never seen it on public television or pay-per-view television. But, yes, they're actually sponsored by this organization. There is a national event which actually carries on not just youth, but actually there are a number of adults that this is a very, very, it's more than a hobby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you for sharing your experience and that of your daughters. Our next testifier, Wiesenthal.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you need to identify yourself for the record, please.
Yep, Jeff Wiesenthal, 13815 Danbury Court, Rosemount, Minnesota. As is indicated before, I have three daughters, which are actually fourth generation in 4-H, which started back with my grandparents. 4-H is very special to me as I met my wife through 4-H, and we're enjoying 30-plus years of marriage, just about as long as I've been a 4-H leader. The things that I'd like to share amongst, as I think anybody that's been affiliated with 4-H has plenty of experiences, but I think one of the strongest attributes for 4-H is its ability to prove its results. It's research-based, and a study that was titled the 4-H Study of Positive Youth Development was developed by the Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, and they had identified these things about 4-H youth. Four times were more likely to make contributions to their communities, two times more likely to be civically active, two times to make healthier choices, two times more likely to participate in STEM activities, and the 4-H girls were two times more likely as a 10th grader or three times more likely as a 12th grader to take part in science programs. Specifically, in Minnesota, 4-H identified in 2013 over 65,000 Minnesota youth participated in the Extension Youth Development Program. It is representative of all areas of the state, 25% farm, 30% rural town, which are under 10,000, 33% town cities between 10,000 and 50,000, 4% suburbs, 2% cities over 50,000. Another contributing factor, one of the hallmarks of 4-H, is a strong volunteer base. In 2013, nearly 11,000 adult volunteers contributed more than 1 million service hours, valued at $23 million to support the positive development of Minnesota youth. There's a large pool, I guess, of money that gets put into 4-H, and at our local level, we really struggle because of many reasons, but every little bit that we're able to put back into the program, as this would give us, helps us to reach out to more individuals. Serving on the City Council for the City of Rosemont, we have three clubs that are within our community, and then the Federation, obviously, within the Dakota County. And we, from Rosemont, one-third of our population is youth, and we have a fair number of active 4-H'ers, and we look at that as a positive youth development within our community. So with that, thank you for the opportunity to share.
Certainly.
This.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions for either Mr. Adams or Mr. Wiesenthal? Senator Clausen, did you have any amendments to your bill?
Madam Chair, I do not.
I would point out to members that it is, and I think it, from what I've read, 1998 is when this length of time was changed from 4 days to five. So it's been a long time at that level. And as you pointed out, there are a lot of these fairs where they last a week. And so this would cover most of them, I think. Is that correct, Senator Clausen?
Madam Chair, we do have, there are 11 fairs, county fairs in the state of Minnesota that are more than 5 days in length. And so passing this proposal would include those in the nonprofit exemption. So our problem is at Dakota County, we have a seven-day fair, and so all of the concession sales are taxed that are run by the 4-H and other nonprofits.
Right. So we understand that. Any further questions or discussion? Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 381 be laid over for further consideration for the omnibus tax bill. Senator Clausen, I like your bill.
No. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members.
Thank you, committee members.
Thank you.
All in favor of Senator Coonan's motion and my endorsement? Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Clausen and gentlemen. Senate File 494, Senator Hall. Hall brings us Senate File 494. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My bill, Senate File 494, is a bill that exempts used goods from being taxed and also motor vehicles from being taxed if they're used. while this bill is in its current format covers both items, excuse me, I'd like to divide it up. And if I believe you have a fiscal impact, I'd like you to refer to that as I go through this. The current Minnesota sales tax is set at 6.875. while some communities do add more, and special goods are taxed even higher, sometimes shy of 10%. The Minnesota has been listed in the Kiplinger's 10 tax-unfriendly states for retirees, number 4 in 2014, number 8 in 2013. Business Insider ranks Minnesota business tax ratings as 45th best overall. Corporate tax rate of 42, individual income tax ranked at 44, sales tax ranked at 36, and property tax at 26. As I start here, I want to, what I refer to as Johnny's story. My youngest son worked all summer and got $3,000 working at the golf range. And he was all set to buy a car, and so we went out looking, and he found this beauty for about $3,000. And as we bought it, we had to say to him, by the way, you realize there's tax onto this. And he said, well, this is a $3,000 car. How much can the tax be? And I said, well, it's going to be about $120. He said, well, $120, Dad, I don't have $120. This is a used car. And you might say, well, he learned a hard lesson in life, that everything might be taxed. But he said, you know, this is not bought from a store. This was from a friend of mine. And how come the state gets taxes? So I want to make note here that a motor vehicle means any self-propelled vehicle that requires to be licensed for the road use, any vehicle propelled or drawn by a self-propelled vehicle required to be licensed for road use. It includes, but is not limited to, cars, vans, pickups, trucks, truck trailers, tractors, trailers, motorhomes, and motorcycles. So I'd like to, as we look over this, Bill, to give you some pros and cons. First off, we might call it an ethical or moral argument. The government has already received funds from the first sale of a vehicle. Getting more revenue for a resale of a vehicle might be good for government, does not necessarily go towards, the taxes not necessarily go towards pollution, which can be caused by cars, or transportation, potholes, and other things. So the question is, should a vehicle be taxed for each owner it has? A decrease in pollution can come from the factories, although this is an untested theory, and we're unsure whether the decrease in the factory pollution would be equal or more than the pollution caused by possible older vehicles. Although we do know that we have pretty high standards now for emissions with older vehicles. We would be one of three states that does not tax used vehicles. The other two, I believe, are Alaska and Oregon, which then could propel a market for used parts and cars. The cons of this, as you've looked at your fiscal note, we're talking about just for cars, $429 million. That's a big chunk of change, and I realize that. We also, of course, again, have the possibility of pollution. Again, we're untested in that, and I think our used cars have done a good job with that. But the main purpose that I've looked at this is a regressive tax. This is a tax not just on the wealthy that can afford new vehicles, but also on everybody that buys a vehicle and those people that are poor or middle class. I look at this and say, what a great idea. Eliminate anything that's used, the tax on anything that's used. And wouldn't that speak volumes to our taxpayers? Because even as I, and I will admit, over the years, have bought used vehicles, I've wondered, why does it get taxed? Not once, not necessarily twice, but maybe up to 10 times, depending upon the vehicle and how many times it gets sold. There was one exemption, though, that was really great. I bought a car from my parents. And you don't get taxed, if you didn't know that, from a car from one of your family members. I think that's still the case.
It's not.
So with that, and again, we're talking about automobile sales, used. And I think the Senate file is appropriate since it's 494. There might be a sign there. So I submit to any questions.
Is there discussion or comments for Senator Hall? Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Senator Hall, how did you or did you plan on finding a way to make up the $800 million out of the transportation fund?
Well, again, it wouldn't be $800 million, but it'd be, you know, 400-some million.
In the biennium, it would be 886.
Okay. I didn't.
Okay.
I'm looking at this from a consumer point of view and a principal point of view. So, no, I didn't do that.
Any further comments? It's a bold plan, Senator Hall.
I understand. I appreciate being heard on it.
You're more than welcome. Any further discussion? Senator Gozelka moves that Senate file 494 be laid over for further consideration for the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Senator Saxhog is still presenting his bill. I believe the department has a short presentation to make. Maybe we could do that now, if that would be okay.
Copies are in members' packets.
Copies of the slides are in members' packets. And if he's still not here when they finish, we'll go on to Senate File 388 at that time.
300-page guide that has everything from 20 to 5
color. Good morning. Who's going to begin? Mr. Cummings, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Paul. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Today, I also have Margaret Reisdorf, who is an attorney, and she will.
Ms. Reisdorf?
And Assistant Commissioner Jenny Starr for our business tax. First of all, we're sort of jumping off from your bill, Senator Rest. Wanted to thank you for putting forward your bill. It really.
388?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Your bill would exempt for purchases by athletic training for youth and adults.
Mr. Cumming, would it be helpful to in your presentation if I presented my bill first and then you commented on it? Would that be better?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that.
Okay, Senator Rest, Senate File 388.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 388 is a bill that was brought to Representative Carlson in the House and me by a constituent who owns and operates a training facility for Olympic athletes who are training for the Olympics. There's a dozen and a half facilities in the state that do this. And to the extent that the people who are training in the facilities are under 18, the purchases made are tax exempt. And the issue was, and the bill provides for tax exemption, sales tax exemption, even if the Olympic athletes that are training are over the age of 18, so therefore are not, quote, youth as defined in the statutes. They're actually, I guess they're maybe six dozen or so organizations that do this kind of training, and it has a fairly minor fiscal impact, and the department will be making a presentation to expand the parameters or the impact of expanding the parameters on this bill beyond that of Olympic training. You're pointing to something. Oh. Olympic training facilities. So that's what the bill does. It's a fairly straightforward one, and we do have a testifier to give you some information about his business.
Okay, welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Todd McIntyre. I'm the founder and chair of Great Prairie Sports, 4824 Georgia Avenue North in Minneapolis.
Crystal. Not Minneapolis.
I was thinking, I'm like, where?
You can just go ahead with your testimony.
Very good. Chair Ress and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you a concept that will allow more Minnesotans to collect precious metals in their future. As a regional director for USA Pentathlon, I am always searching for opportunities of not just raising revenues, but to also reduce expenses. When I applied last year to receive a sales tax exemption, my application was rejected on the basis that we do not exclusively work with youth athletes. The wording of the current law provides a sales tax exemption to teams and clubs which offer sport development exclusively to youth, which is generally defined by the age of 18 and younger. Everyone will agree that the pinnacle of amateur sport is the Olympic Games. Our state's history is full of athletes who endured stress, financial challenges, injuries, and other obstacles to earn an Olympic medal. Some of those athletes include Lindsey Vonn in alpine skiing, Tom Malkow in swimming, Pete Fence and Sean Rajeski, Joseph Polo, John Schuster, and Scott Baird in curling, and who could ever forget the men's 1980 USA hockey team that included 12 players from Minnesota and coached by one of St. Paul's finest, Herb Brooks. It takes tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop youth into Olympic athletes. While many other countries finance their Olympic training through their own treasuries, athletes in the United States generally self-pay their Olympic dreams. By passing this bill, the state of Minnesota would offer its support of various sport clubs in their development of youth into Olympic medalists. We all know, or should know, Michael Phelps, the most accomplished swimmer in the history of the sport, started swimming at the age of 7 and has largely been swimming with the North Baltimore Aquatic Club since the age of 10. For the past 19 years, Michael Phelps has been training under his lifelong coach, Bob Bowman. If Michael Phelps swam and trained for a local 501c3 nonprofit swim club known as the North Twin Cities Aquatic Club, they would lose their sales tax exemption because under current law, again, sales tax exemption is only available to groups who exclusively train youth. Through your efforts, this bill will allow clubs and teams to accomplish more community development, scholarship more athletes to national and international competitions, hire more coaches, and procure more training equipment. In short, this bill enables more Minnesota athletes to compete in the Olympic Games. If it takes a village to raise a child, then the state will be able to raise up a new generation of athletes by leveraging additional sales tax exemptions into Olympic medals. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ardern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest. I am just now starting to get the curling thing, so I'm new to understanding that sport. But I have a serious question about where this type of sales tax exemption would fit into the range of priorities for you in your chairmanship when it comes to, like, the capital upfront equipment sales tax that folks are paying in advance and getting refunds. I for one, would like to see the second one as a higher priority. Although this is also a priority, I think it would help the committee to know where you see this fitting into the range of priorities.
Senator Rest.
Well, Senator Ortman, I like to think that when a constituent comes to me with a problem that represents in their minds an inequity in the law, that I'm going to bring it to the tax committee. In terms of my priorities, I have, and Senator Scoy and I are working on property tax relief. We're looking on working on June accelerated sales tax. We're looking at vendor allowances with regard to the collection of sales tax. We're looking at the statewide business property tax, and I'm looking after Mr. McIntyre's business, just as you would. So I'm not going to list priorities in numbers, but my constituents are important to me, just as they are to you. And when they bring an idea that actually now is being taken up by the department, I'm going to pursue it, and I'll have a bill to deal with that. And actually, Mr. McIntyre bringing the bill forward has raised a broader tax policy issue, and that is the difference in the way in which otherwise tax-exempt organizations are treated under the income tax code and the sales tax exemptions. And the presentation that Mr. Cummings and the attorneys from the department are going to make in just a moment, it is going to address that. And so I do think it's an important tax policy issue for our committee to consider.
Senator Ortman.
Senator Russ, I do think it begs the question about who are we taxing with these sales taxes and who gets the exemption and why, and we've had that conversation for several years about whether local governments should have it, and then what about local government-owned entities. And that's what I'm getting at, is not that this isn't a great idea and meritorious. I'm saying how do we do that? And maybe the department can help us with an overview of what's happening here. But ultimately, this committee and the next tax committee is going to have to set some priorities and hopefully an overarching policy that makes sense, that we're doing, that we have an approach that makes sense for everybody and not just in a piecemeal fashion, because that's we've been there for a very long time.
Senator Rez.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, I appreciate your comments.
Okay, any further questions for Senator Rez or Mr. McIntyre from the committee? Okay, Senator Rez.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 388 be laid over for further consideration, and I hope that the department's presentation will further enlighten the committee and the division trying to come to a rational approach for how 501c3s are treated federally and by the state in the income tax system and in the sales tax system, and let me assure you they're not identical. So with that, that's my motion.
Okay, and to Senator Rest's motion, any further discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank
motion
you,
Mr. carries.
Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Cummings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First, I wanted to thank Senator Rest for bringing forward this bill. When we heard this, and then also heard about some of the issues that the taxpayer had dealt with, we wanted to just bring this forward to the committee as a symptom of a larger problem. So the underlying laws related to nonprofits are complicated. But we wanted to, and there's very valid reasons on why over the years the legislature and various administrations have tried to thread a needle related to nonprofits. You know, exempting and encouraging these nonprofit purposes is important. That's also sort of balanced with making sure that taxing similarly situated situations and transactions is done at a consistent level, whether they're nonprofit or profit. And that's also balanced with, you know, generating revenue for public purposes. So, you know, a nonprofit, you know, if they are coming in just as the testifier did, if I'm on a 501c3, I'm going into the department, I'm applying for a sales tax exemption for purchases, and then the department in the situation of the taxpayer said, well, not so. And the reason is, as you alluded to, Madam Chair, is that the income tax and the sales tax do have two different standards in which people are weighed against in terms of there is a federal standard for 501c3, and then there is a separate state standard for the sales tax that Ms. Reisdorf and Assistant Commissioner Starr will go into. So I wanted to turn it over to our attorney, Margaret Reisdorf, to just talk about some of the differences between the federal and the state standard and how the state standard has been looked at through various types of decisions over time.
Okay. My name is Margaret Reisdorf. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I work primarily in sales tax. And so I echo, so as Paul mentioned, we oftentimes charitable organizations or organizations that qualify as income tax exempt federally will then apply to the state for sales tax exempt status. And we do have a different standard. The way our statutes work is that the state income tax directly looks to the federal income tax for exempt status. So if you're exempt under the Internal Revenue Code or Subchapter F, you are exempt for income tax purposes, but sales tax does not. We have always had an exemption for nonprofit organizations at the state level for sales tax since 1967, but it's limited. Only religious, educational, and exclusively charitable organizations qualify as exempt. And now, educational and religious are fairly straightforward. Where it gets really complicated is in the charitable area, because the Minnesota Supreme Court has issued decisions over the years that have required us to apply factors, and even since 2007, put very stringent requirements on charities in order for them to qualify. And so oftentimes an organization that is exempt as a charity for income tax purposes, both at the federal and state level, will not qualify as a charity for sales tax, which, you know, causes confusion and frustration. And so that's all, I guess. Oh, and so that... So what we've seen over the years, because of this dissonance, is we've seen periodically new exemptions being added. For instance, in 97, nonprofit hospitals exemption was added. Nonprofit surgical centers was added. Veteran organizations in 1980, critical access dental care just here in 2013, and then nonprofit nursing homes in 2013 as well. And so we see kind of an incremental approach deal with the situation that our definition, as interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court for charitable, is very narrow.
Members of the committee, my name is Jenny Starr, Assistant Commissioner for Business Taxes at the Department of Revenue. And I would just add, from the sales tax division's perspective as an administrative matter, that because federal income tax laws really drive sort of our common understanding of what a nonprofit or a charity is. Most of us might show up to a fundraising event when we might donate some dollars. We get a letter back from our favorite charity letting us know that that donation is deductible on our income taxes. Because of that interaction with the income tax code, we've all sort of come to share a generally accepted understanding of what a charity is. As from an administrative perspective, charities go to the Internal Revenue Service and fill out Federal Form 1023 to show that they meet that charitable standard. The last time I checked, the full form is 30-some pages long, so our charities go through a lot of effort and work
to obtain that charitable exempt status for income tax purposes from the federal government. And they sort of, after going through that rigorous process, right, they see themselves as charitable under our sort of accepted social understanding. Then they come to the Department of Revenue and ask for their sales tax exemption to be granted. We hand them Minnesota Form ST-16. Now, I want you to know that that is not 30 pages long. It's a short, concise, user-friendly form. But what happens frequently is that charities find out that for Minnesota sales tax purposes, they don't meet Minnesota's statutory and case law narrower standard. And that just definitely creates a dissonance for our customers and a frustration in that moment. So it is a larger sort of administrative difficulty that the department faces.
Senator Ortman, are you finished?
Madam Chair, we're completed with our presentation. Okay. We'd be happy to take questions.
Are there questions or comments? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there similar application of those factors to property taxes?
In 2007, there was a landmark state Supreme Court case under the Rainbow, which the Supreme Court, up until that time, sales tax, since the Mayo decision in 1975, the sales tax and property tax, the Supreme Court had viewed both of our charitable exempt statutes as being substantially similar. So you'll often see sales tax cases cited in property tax decisions and vice versa. But in 2007, under the Rainbow, it's a property tax case, the Supreme Court said for the first time that of the six factors that we look at for determining whether or not an organization is charitable, that one is required. And the one that's required is the one that requires that the charity give their goods and services away substantially. And this caused some concern because in the charitable community, there's a lot of good benevolent work that goes on that does by organizations that have difficulty with giving their services away. And so there was a study that was launched, and the property tax statutes were substantially modified in 2009. So I believe it's 272.02 subdivision 7, which is the property tax charitable statute. There is now greater discretion given to local assessors with regard to factor 3, this giving something away, and allows them some more flexibility there. Similar changes were not made to the sales tax statute, so we still operate under the holdings of the state Supreme Court.
Senator, want to follow up?
Sure. So if we went and adopted, say we just adopted the federal standards for sales taxes, if we were to adopt the similar standards in terms of the definition for property taxes, wouldn't that have an impact on our local governments?
Ms. Reisdorf, Mr. Cummings.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we think at this point it would. There was, as it relates to the, as this bill was coming forward, we worked with our sales tax division to try and what would be the impact in terms of the alignment between the federal standard and the state standard. In terms of what this would do for local units of government or the property taxes, that is not something that we have analyzed to the point we have with the sales tax. We did provide the committee with a handout on what are the types of organizations that would be impacted under the sales tax. And that would, so I think that's helpful in defining the impact. We know that the fiscal impact in terms of aligning the state sales tax and the income tax standards would be about $7 million for the biennium. But in terms of, to your question, have we analyzed the impact for property taxes? We haven't at this time.
Madam Chair.
Sure. Senator Ortman.
I think it's important to have that information in order to have this conversation. Right now, we've got sales and property taxes that are following one set of standards and guidelines, and the income taxes setting another. Before we change, I think we need to look at the whole picture, and I think the local units of government would be vastly affected here if we had new definitions of nonprofits not paying property taxes, that would be a huge change and a huge burden extended to other taxpayers. So I'm not necessarily opposed to looking at it, but I think we need to have the bigger picture all put together.
Further comment or questions from members? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I pulled up the form on the website here, and just to give people some examples of organizations that do qualify for the sales tax exemption would be churches, private schools, colleges, museums, historical societies, youth organizations, senior citizen groups, and volunteer fire departments. Examples of organizations that do not qualify, and some of these I think we would have a hard time arguing that they should, are city-run celebrations, homeowners associations, fraternities, sororities, lake improvement associations, and then there's some others in between, medical clinics, JCs, Kiwanis clubs, Lions clubs, Chambers of Commerce, and Knights of Columbus. So it shows the broad range of groups, and having worked at a local level, I know property taxes, that is a big issue because a lot of the organizations come in and just assume that they get their 501c3, that they don't have to pay property taxes, and sometimes they go into, they come close to forfeiture because, I've actually had to call them and go, you know, you have this assessment due, and they don't understand that they have to pay property taxes. But, and then there's also a lot of groups where I know the cities literally, they don't argue with them, but they have to literally walk through the process because they just assume. And I'm not going to say it, I agree with her. I think we need more information. And I think there's some groups that I think it might be easier to say they fit, and others where I think we would, I would have some concern just giving it to them.
Mr. Cummings?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Dietzick pointed out many different examples of organizations. But I wanted to be clear that that is not a list that would be covered if we were to move to the federal standard. I think that is more of a list of people asking, right? And so we are trying to make sure that we're providing some clarity there. It is a smaller list who would be under the federal standard. And I know the handout that we had is helpful in sort of understanding what that audience might be. Mm-hmm. We point out scientific organizations, testing for public safety, literary organizations, amateur athletic organizations. You know, there are a few other examples, but the list, Senator Dietzick, that you were referencing is a much broader list that encompasses more than just 501c3, which is not what we're talking about here today. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Reisdorf might have some more comments.
Right. I would only add that I believe under 501c, there are 29 different categories, and we are only referring to the 501c3 subdivision there. So that, just wanted to clarify that.
Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, one other point here. Oftentimes, these organizations own investment property. And I think we don't want to see these organizations that are buying property for investment purposes and long-term financial planning being exempt from property taxes. I just think we need to have a much bigger conversation about making the change for sales taxes and its implications for property taxes.
Mr. Cummings, or any of you, is there a response to that?
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to note that that I think that what we're talking about in your bill and then what we're trying to discuss as a larger problem mm-hmm. would be limited to sales tax. So I just wanted to try and make that point. I think, Senator Ortman, your point is well taken, that that continuing to have more knowledge about the property tax area and its alignment or misalignment with the 501c3 standard is important.
That's a good discussion we need mm-hmm. to have. I would agree with that. Anything further, Ms. Stark?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, just to clarify about current law, okay, the sales tax exemption for purchases only applies to those purchases that are directly tied to your charitable benevolent purpose. Just to know for current law and even in this discussion about the scope of what charities receive that exemption, we're still talking about purchases only being made for benevolent purpose.
So a coffee shop and a hospital pay sales tax on its purchases, as well as the hospital has to report unrelated business income. Is that correct?
Correct. And Madam Chair's members, I don't mean to continue sort of an unnecessary discussion. I just wanted people to be clear about the current law.
Sure. Okay. Anything further? Then thank you, Mr. Cummings. I appreciate the information, and we'll certainly take it under consideration as we try to bring some rationality to the sales tax law in this area. Thank you very much, all three of you. Senator Saxog, Senate File 929. Senator Saxog, is the bill in the shape you wanted, or do you have any amendments?
No, it's in the shape we need it, Madam Chair.
Okay, then just proceed.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for your patience. It's that time of year, and we've got bills all over. Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 929. This bill makes changes to the way sales tax is applied when buying modular homes. With me today is Mark Bruner from Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. He'll give a brief presentation and help answer any questions that the committee might have.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Bruner.
Mr. Bruner, thank you very much, and continue with your testimony.
See, I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association. I'd like to thank Senator Saxog for bringing the bill. And just to clarify, this bill deals with modular homes, not manufactured homes. And, you know, while they're, you know, oftentimes built in the same plant, the difference is modular homes are built to the state building code and are considered part of the IRC, inspected by the Department of Labor and Industry, a part of the state building code. Manufactured homes are built to a federal building code, which is also a part of the state building code. But modular homes always are sited on a permanent foundation and are always real property. You know, they may be 1,500 to 5,000 square feet in size. They're, you know, come in different sections to the home site, put together with a crane. The Minnesota currently has 16 plants building modular homes. That's up from 9 plants in 2009. And it's not necessarily that the modular housing market has taken off in Minnesota, but these plants are strategically located and have been able to take advantage of the Bakken oil shale expansion in the western states. The Canadian market has really opened up. So a lot of what we build are exported outside of Minnesota that are modular homes. In the last quarter of 2012, Department of Labor and Industry and an organization called IBC, which does the inspections in the plants, rated Minnesota as the number one producer of new modular homes. I'm not sure that we're at that point today, but at least you know, we've seen significant growth. And there are actually, and what the bill does is address sort of a disparity in terms of how someone would pay modular sales tax on a new home or, say, the same home. And one of the ways that someone would pay their sales tax is if they bought the home directly from the builder or the manufacturer, and then the builder installed it on the foundation. They would pay sales tax on the materials only for the home, similar to a site-built home. If you bought the home from a sales center or a dealership somewhere in the state of Minnesota, you would then pay sales tax on the dealer's cost or the invoice amount of the home, the full sales tax rate. If, however, you bought the home from the sales center as the homeowner and then did your own work in terms of doing your own basement, foundation, that kind of thing, which happens in greater Minnesota more so, you would then pay sales tax on the full sales price of the home. So you have these three different ways of calculating sales tax, and what the bill does is try to sort of streamline that process. It continues to allow someone who purchases their home from the manufacturer or the builder to pay only on the cost of materials, because the builder obviously knows what those costs are. And then what it also does is allows that builder or manufacturer
to contract with someone, say in the local community, to actually do the foundation work, that kind of thing, rather than them doing it themselves. In some cases, they may not have, you know, internal contractors to do that work. So that's the change on that part of it. And then what else the bill does is simply says that whether you buy your home from a model home sales center dealership and have them do the installation foundation, or if you do it yourself, you'll pay sales tax on 65% of the dealer's cost or the invoice amount. And the 65% relates to how manufactured homes are taxed for sales tax purposes. And the idea is that 65% of the invoice amount then allows you to have some basis for only taxing materials for the home, not labor, and then it doesn't tax the markup that goes with the sale of the home. So that's essentially what the bill does, Madam Chair.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Saxhog or for Mr. Brunner? I would just point out to members that I think sometimes it's hard to understand the sales tax on items that involve installation or labor or separation from materials, et cetera, in a given industry or a given type of product. And I think that the revenue estimate really does separate that out and clarifies what the current treatment of manufactured homes and whether they modular homes. You made clear that was a distinction. Modular homes that are uninstalled, installed by the manufacturer, are installed by the dealer, and just trying to come up with a single approach to all three variations. Is that essentially it? Would you say, Mr. Brunner?
Yes, that's our intent. Thank you.
All right, questions or comments for Mr. Brunner or Senator Saxhog? Seeing none, then Senator Eaton moves that Senate file 929 be laid over for further consideration for the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
We have not yet. Thank you very much, Senator Saxhog. I would ask members to look at the minutes from the March 3rd meeting and tell me if any corrections need to be made. Senator Thompson?
I'll move the minutes.
Senator Thompson moves the minutes from the March 3rd meeting to be approved. All in favor of that motion, please say yes. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. We will be meeting next Monday and Wednesday of the coming week. The full committee will be meeting on Tuesday and Thursday and tomorrow. And I know the division will be meeting at 8:30, and assuming the full committee will also be meeting at 8:30. Any further comments? Then Senator Eaton moves we adjourn. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Committee stands adjourned. Thank you very much.